Hello and welcome to New Business Paradigms. I'm Matt Renner, the Executive Director of the World Business Academy, and I'm here with Ronaldo Brutico, the Academy's President and Founder. The World Business Academy is a nonprofit business think tank and action incubator dedicated to transforming the consciousness of business leaders, business students, and the public at large in order to inspire business to take responsibility for the whole of society. We're recording this show on May 3rd, 2017. It feels extra important to give our audience the date because the news is moving so fast. But the big trends are what we want to focus on today, especially the looming recession. So let's start there, Ronaldo. What's in the cards for the U.S. and global economy?
Well, hi, Matt, and hi to all our listeners. It's great to be back with you all. You know, with the speed with which things change, having the show on a monthly basis is almost too infrequent, and I hope people are starting to get my tweets because I've been tweeting in between shows. And in the tweet I did a couple of days ago, I doubled down on my prediction that we will be in recession before the end of this year. So by the fourth quarter of this year, we will be in recession. And what does that mean? The beginning of a recession can never be measured because you must have two consecutive quarters of negative growth, technically, to qualify a recession. So you really don't know till three or four quarters go by when that actually started. So when I say the recession will be started by the fourth quarter, that means when the fourth quarter is measured, probably in the second quarter of 2018, people will realize, oh, gee, we had a recession started in the fourth quarter or sooner. Why do I say that? And by the way, we started talking about this, Matt, last November, that I saw this coming as a possibility. In December, I said, I'm pretty clear it's going to happen. And then I've been doubling down ever since. And then I issued this tweet based on a couple of reasons. First of all, and by the way, the Fed just today acknowledged the business slowdown has occurred, but has taken the optimistic assessment, which I think is incorrect, that it's a temporary slowdown. It's actually part of a permanent decrease of economic activity. I can explain why if you want, but basically, we only have an annualized growth rate today, as of the most recent numbers, of 0.7%. So we're less than 1% growth annualized, meaning for the full year, we'll have less than 1% growth at the current rate. Why do I think that will get even worse? Well, first of all, we only created 95,000 jobs last month, which is a dramatic drop from the 250,000 we were averaging for the 70-some months before that under Obama. So that's a big factor, that we are dropping jobs. Number two, retail continues to languish. Retail has 30 plus, maybe 33 million workers in America. They're getting laid off. They're not getting hired. We're looking at the current Easter season's just completed, and it doesn't look like it's been a big pop. And by the way, when I say the decrease in retail, if you take the electronic retail out of the equation, so the Amazon online buying, et cetera, if you take that out of the equation and you just look at brick and mortar retail stores, the deterioration in the retail picture is even worse than it appears. So, for example, you're seeing major store closings by Macy's. We believe Penny's has already done some. They'll be doing some more. You see Kmart and Sears both telling the public that they're going to go bankrupt. Literally, they're about to fall through the floor. They've announced that. You look at places like Saks Fifth Avenue that's been closing stores, and now they're even closing their Saks Off Fifth, which is their discount chain. So we're talking about substantial pain in the retail brick and mortar sector.
Can I ask you a question about that, Ronaldo?
Sure.
So on retail and brick and mortar versus electronic or online retail, is the difference there that the brick and mortar stores support more jobs and have more economic kind of activity?
Correct.
Okay, I wanted to clarify.
It's not just a little bit more. So there are no retail clerks in the electronic world. Now you have warehouse people. Retail chains have warehouse people too. So it's not, tailored brands, we have plenty of warehouse people, but we have way more people who work in our stores at Joseph A. Banks and Men's Warehouse and K&G, et cetera.
Right.
So when you have a cutback in retail, you're losing what used to be the old blue collar job is the white collar entry level retail position. And we are seeing that deterioration, which will add to downward pressure on employment. and it will add to the pressures on the economy, because when people lose their job, they spend less, obviously. And when their friends hear about them losing a job, their friends spend less. So what I'm seeing is a continuing deterioration. Now, what the administration is doing in the face of that is absolutely the exact opposite thing you want to do if you want to stop a recession. So, for example, you don't want people to be fearful, because if they're fearful, then they will tighten up and not spend. So the administration, by drumming up more fear, whether it's over Korea or whether it's over, I mean, you pick your favorite topic, fear basically got this administration into office, and they keep beating on the fear drum in order to try and stay in office. I mean, even the comment yesterday by the president that, you know, what we need is a good old-fashioned government shutdown. I mean, am I the only one that thought that was bizarre? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, Matt, what did you think of that?
Yeah, no, it's rare that people are rooting for government shutdowns from inside government as if they're something productive. Every administration that's had one has taken a lot of political punishment for it.
Yeah, and it's, but to ask for one and you're the president, it's crazy. So what it does is it stirs up, oh my God, they're going to close the government. Maybe I shouldn't buy that new thing. And remember, I started predicting for you that auto sales would be one of the first things to fall.
Yeah.
And sure enough, that's what's been happening the last couple of months. In fact, I was delighted to see, sad, but delighted to see, that the New York Times did a major story on it just today. And the lead on the story says, U.S. auto sales are in retreat in this year. And one of the statistics that I think are particularly difficult is the sales have dropped so low that they're now talking about the largest inventory on the streets in their dealer showrooms than they've had since 2004. Now, General Motors plant in Lansing, Michigan, 1,100 workers are being laid off this month. They'll be out of work for at least the next 5 months. There are plant shift reductions that affect another 3,000 workers. These are well-paying jobs, right? So when you see these kinds of things happening, you go, gee, what the administration needs to be doing is to beat the success drum, get people confident, get them spending again, because in our economy, which is driven by consumer spending, you really want to see people excited and happy in spending. So we're going to tighten the spiral. So you're going to see worse information, worse news on the job front, and you're going to see a continuing deterioration in retail. You're going to see it for the rest of the year, and you're going to see a continued deterioration of the economy. And when you're only at 0.7% of growth now, it doesn't take long to get to zero or below. So that's what's going to happen by the third or fourth quarter of this year. I think that's, you know, one quick way to look at it. I think that the tax plan, which frankly is not a tax plan. I mean, anything that's, you know, 1.5 pages and contains no numbers can't be a tax plan.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that was something that people heard, you know, through the media, that Trump had introduced some sort of tax plan. And if you drill down into it, what you're saying is that it was just a 1 or 2 pages of talking points without a real, it couldn't be described as a budget, because a budget generally has a revenue side, or at least how are you going to balance this tax cut. So it's much more of a tax cut plan than any kind of
it is a quasi-religious document. You know, it's like, on our in faith we believe that we can do these things that defy gravity, when in fact you can't.
To Saint Laffer.
Yeah, I mean, the Laffler curve is back in renewed vigor. Laffler, yeah. And Laffler curve, that got laughed out of economics, you know, in the Reagan years, and it's back again. No, I think the idea of reducing the taxes on the wealthy is insane at a time when the discontinuity between the rich and the poor is growing every year. The idea of giving the top 1% huge tax breaks when they're already paying too little tax, crazy. The idea of dropping the interest deduction for mortgages, which has been floated around to pay for this thing, crazy. When you talk about the economic benefits of dramatic tax cuts, there aren't any. So there is no tax plan. It doesn't exist. And that article, the document, which is basically a prayer to the tax gods for some way to create more revenue in the economy through economic growth and deliver more benefits to the rich and let the poor keep shouldering the balance. It's just crazy. It's just nonsensical. And that people would in the media would even call it a tax plan when there isn't a single number in it. A tax plan, by definition, tells you, here's what we're recommending for the taxes, Here's who's going to pay them. Here's what the effect is, and here's how it all works out in the end.
Right.
None of that was there. None.
So let me drill down on that a little bit with you. I agree with everything you just said. My question is, so the idea of cutting corporate tax rates and at the same time getting rid of a lot of loopholes, or as they're called, or basically payoffs to some special interests, it seems like an interesting and somewhat sensical goal if you do it in conjunction with a real effort to rebalance the entire tax system and simplify it. Where do you come down on that?
Okay, first of all, there are smart things you could do. None of them were evident in that document, which I call a prayer, not a plan. Now, what could you do if you wanted to totally, really, really revise the U.S. tax code? And as you know, I was at one point earlier in my career a certified expert in tax court. So this is something I'm somewhat familiar with. And the tax code, first of all, is not designed to create revenue. It's a social code. It's designed to control conduct. So if you want certain kinds of conduct, give it a tax break. If you want to prohibit other kinds of conduct, you tax it. And what happens is society will follow your lead. So that's really what the tax code is. It's not about revenue generation. It's really about how to run the country.
Now, so, I mean, so you're saying essentially the side benefit is revenue generation, or you're just saying that's not the only goal?
No, I think revenue generation is the secondary goal.
Right, okay.
Shaping who wins and loses is the primary goal. And that's why wealthy people and large corporations have enormous power in Washington, because they can afford to pay the lobbyists and the lawyers to draft legislation with consecutive loopholes that enriches them year after year at greater and greater expense to the public. And this is why we have a disequilibrium between the rich and the poor.
And we have something like a 17,000-page tax code or something like that.
Oh, well, it's bigger than that, because you're only looking at the code itself. You're not looking at the rev procs or the rev rulings. And if you were to take and look at the all of the documents that control our tax issues in this country,
just
in
the federal
one room,
yeah,
just the federal level, you'd be a three-story building, and every shelf would be lined with paper that was printed on thin sheets on two sides. I mean, it's enormous. It's all the revenue rulings, the rev pocs, and everything that comes out in conjunction with it. And so, when you look at all this stuff, you got to pay a lot of money for somebody like me to go read it, and then you got to pay us a lot of money to go change it. And that's what happens in Washington. So now, but let's go back to your original question.
Yeah.
If you, in fact, wanted to do the most fair tax code that created revenue increases, and you wanted to do that in a way that would drive the social objective of closing the gap between the richest and the poorest, and funding your basic infrastructure, funding your education, funding your medical efforts, the way to do that is to not have a flat tax, which, as you know, is regressive. It would be probably a combination of a national sales tax, or value-added tax, as it's called in Europe, which would begin to tax consumption as opposed to income. And then you would want to match that with some form of what's called a negative income tax. So a negative income tax is, if you are below a certain line, the government pays you. If you're above a certain line, you pay the government. And that's a progressive tax matched with a value-added tax. You would raise the most revenue, and you would correct all the defects in society you're looking at now. Who would not win on such a situation? Well, the people who would not win are large corporate interests. So when they have a 39% tax rate, which is their so-called effective tax rate — effective tax rate means if you paid exactly what you were supposed to and there are no exemptions, you'd be paying 39%. You get companies like IBM who got a check back from the government and paid no taxes this year. You have companies like GE that pay virtually no taxes. I could go on and on. So to have a 39% effective rate means nothing if the real rate you're paying is zero. And that's what tax loopholes do. And I think people generally understand that. And I think they generally are upset by it. But that's really how you would create a revenue-appropriate, socially responsible tax plan.
Very interesting. Okay, so without that, and with this recession looming, let's get back here to what you see coming as a result of both this, what we could call a flimsy attempt at a at a tax outline one pager, and other action that could impact the stock market and the bond market and the economy as a whole, like this action by the Senate, or sorry, by the House today, that they just passed a spending bill. Do you want to get into the spending bill and what happened there?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm really happy with the spending bill. I mean, I think there's more good news than bad news in that bill. Do you agree?
Yeah, it's pretty shocking compared to the budget outline that was handed down by the administration, which was incredibly ham-fisted and aggressive, cutting, you know, EPA and State Department. And
take EPA. EPA was supposed to be cut by 99%. It got cut by 1%. Basically didn't get cut, right? EPA has been kept intact. No cuts to Planned Parenthood. No penalties on sanctuary cities. Zero funding for the border wall, specifically excluded, although there was a small increase, which I think is appropriate for border security, i.e. for patrols and technology. Boosted military spending of $12 to $15 billion. I'm not wild about it, but that's pretty nominal. I mean, $12 billion in the military world is not even the price of coffee pots.
Yeah.
And we are continuing to wage wars more aggressively still in the Middle East. And so a military spending increase of some sort is at least logical, even if it's not acceptable to me.
So it's interesting though, because they haven't done a five months budget, or almost like a budget, a continuing resolution, but a longer term one in a while. And this one, it gives us 5 months without having this fight again, if the Senate passes it.
Well, I think it's also something else. What it's giving you is a picture of how the Republican Congress, meaning both the House and the Senate, is dealing with a Republican president who doesn't seem to understand how to govern. And so they're having to bend over backwards to help govern, because they're afraid the public would correctly perceive that if there was a shutdown, there's no question who they blame. The Republicans would get blamed in spades. And they don't want to go into the 2018 elections with an albatross around their neck. Now, I think they're going to anyway, but that's what they want to avoid. And this program is not about politics. This program is about economics. So from the economic point of view, this budget actually was a good one. And I think, I mean, surprisingly good, given that it's so little of what that Trump really was after got put into the budget. So I'm very pleased with the spending resolution, and I think it's indicative of what's going to happen when they get down to September. Now, let's say that, just for the heck of it, that my prediction is correct, that everybody's going to know what I know by September, i.e. the recession's here or about to be here. If everybody knows that in September, you're going to see some more intelligent budgeting, I think. So this is going to get us to the point where people are going to be smart enough to be scared about what's going on in Washington. And the next budget could take you all the way through an entire year of intelligent thinking, which will help. Now, it won't get you out of the recession. To get out of the recession, we're going to need some very thoughtful people like Paul Krugman, Stiglitz, frankly, myself. We have lots of ways to get people out of recessions, but I don't think this administration and this Congress is going to adopt them. So I think that the recession, which starts this year, is going to accelerate once it begins. So get ready, folks. Fasten your seatbelts for 2018.
On that note, Ronaldo, so this is relatively good news then, but you're still saying that this isn't good enough to keep us out of the downturn.
No, this is good news in terms of the spending resolution, not good enough to have an impact, not good enough to be able to stop the recession that's coming. What it did do is it didn't make it worse. You follow me?
Yeah. Yep.
And it's not inflationary, which is what I think the Tea Party insisted on. I think the contribution of the Tea Party, or so-called Freedom Caucus, their contribution in this budget is they didn't want it to be a inflationary, out of control budget. And I think that's where the trades all occurred. It wasn't because the Senate has a filibuster rule.
I also think that they decided to kind of punt on this one to have their other fights about health care and potentially some sort of tax reform in the meantime. But that's my guess.
Stay with that. Now, so health care, just to let you know, health care was a disguised tax deduction.
Absolutely.
That's what that was. Right. It wasn't about health care.
So let's talk about that. Let's do it quickly, but I just want to talk about that. So what you're saying is that essentially the taxes that were involved in Obamacare, the ACA when it passed, to pay for the health care insurance subsidies There was a tax on the wealthiest Americans, I think, earning over $250,000. That was
And anybody making over $250,000 a year can afford it.
Right, and what the reaction to ACA has been about, aside from just the general lack of care for poor people that we've seen from this Republican Party in the last few years, we also saw that they hated the fact that there was a tax increase there. And so that's, I think, what actually really made the elites in that party so upset. And that was the number one priority of getting rid of Obamacare for them.
Well, I mean, who knows what it was. I think it was also a political hobby horse because, you know, I mean, look at the survey they did after the election. Apparently some huge number, like two-thirds of the people, thought that the Obamacare was something different than ACA. Right. You know, so when they'd say, you can get rid of Obamacare because I got my Affordable Care Act to protect me, not realizing that was the same thing. So, I don't want to speculate on the political stuff again, and we can get into a lot of politics. I don't think the politics is as relevant here as the economics. And the economics is that was a disguised tax cut for the wealthy, which they were hoping to get so they wouldn't have to reach as far in the tax bill. So they have more maneuvering room, right?
Right.
See how this is fitting together? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have that maneuvering room now, which is going to make it even more difficult to get a tax cut through like they want. It's going to get very, very difficult to get it through.
So that's all good, and we got to keep watching that because the bill is back, the health care bill is back. We don't know what form it's in yet. So stay tuned, everyone, on that.
Well, it's back, ACA. And I think everybody, don't go to sleep. Be very aggressive because it would be insane for what I've seen as the proposal to get through Congress. On every level, it would be insane. So stay vigilant. Call your Congress people. Make sure they don't take a dive. But it looks like Republicans – particularly some of the more conservative but not Tea Party Republicans are stopping this thing. And I think that's what should happen. And then let's get on with life. Quit pushing it, Speaker Ryan. Now, when it comes to the tax cut, therefore, if they don't get it, which Trump very well knows, then they're going to have to try and get more massive tax cuts for the rich in order to produce for the rich what they're trying. And that's going to be untenable because it would create too big a deficit. So you see how this all winds around itself. But either way, I keep coming back to this conversation isn't going to be happening in a vacuum. This conversation is going to be happening with the darkening clouds of recession growing more obvious to everybody every day. Right. Now, people who listen to this show, they've been hearing about it for 5-6 months. The average person hasn't heard about it yet. They don't know we're going into recession. Right. They don't know how good they've had it. And they're about to find out that it ain't that good anymore.
In terms of the stock market, you're predicting something around a 20% correction coming. Can you talk about that?
At least it's about 30% overvalued right now. If you look at historical ratios, whenever the market gets above 12 PE, meaning price to earnings, and we covered that in the last show, the price earnings ratio. And so if anybody wants to know what that is, please go back to the last month's show and you'll hear the long discussion of price earnings. So at a 12 PE, which is what you would say at the high historically you would achieve, it's not a recession number. It's actually kind of a strong economic number, meaning the economy would be good to produce 12 PE. We're at 17. And we're about to go into a recession. And I know how hard Wall Street's trying to keep that number pumped up because they're trying to pull little people into the market. So when the big guys pull out, they'll have money to take from the little guys once again. But that's what's going on, by the way. There's nobody smart in Wall Street that thinks this thing is viable at 17 PE. Now, what they do think is if they were to get a tax cut, corporate tax cut from, say, a 39% effective rate down to 15%, the amount of profit that would throw on the P&Ls, on the financial statements of every company that qualifies for that rate, which is all the big companies in the country, they would see a huge increase in income. Therefore, their price times their earnings, their income ratio, would come back into line. In fact, well into line. It would be, there might be another couple of points that you could go up. So that's how they're trying to get themselves bailed out of this overpriced market. Now, there is no thoughtful person that watches Wall Street, that's any kind of an economist or financial advisor, who doesn't know what I just said is true. None. They all realize the market's overvalued. So the question is, what's the correction going to be? I would say it's about 30% overvalued, but I think a 20% plus correction is more likely because as it starts to drop down by 20% plus, there will be any number of stories that will get spun as to why it shouldn't go any lower. And I do believe that will temporarily arrest the downward spiral. Might not. If it doesn't, then you're going to see a 30% correction. But 20+ is definitely what's in the cards as far as I can tell.
Okay. And what is that? What is the implication then on a 20% correction? And when do you think that would be happening? I mean, does that go before the recession officially starts?
Can't tell. You can't tell because, see, you can't tell when is Wall Street going to give up on the false belief that they're going to get a massive tax cut? Once Wall Street gets that can't happen, the market's going to fall. I would say that's probably going to happen before the recession. But in any event, I don't know that they're going to get a tax bill done before the recession is obvious. I can't tell with my crystal ball is not that clear. In other words, I don't know. No one can tell us.
Right.
I think Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, just recently said it's going to be like August before we can have the tax bill up. Well, August to have the tax bill up, September to negotiate and discuss it. I'm telling you the recession is going to be here in spades by October, November. So, they're going to know it's here. So what's going to happen when they put that tax bill together and all of a sudden at the time they're asking for more reductions for business and for the wealthy, all of a sudden revenues at the federal level are dropping because people are now in recession, which drops the tax revenues dramatically. And now whatever you would have done that would have been inflationary to start with is even worse. You follow that logic?
Yep.
So I don't know whether you're going to see the tax bill. Let's just say the tax bill goes up in August, September. Everybody's talking about the recession coming on by then, or it's already there. And they go, oh, my God, what are we going to do? I don't think the prayer that was released last week, disguised as a tax plan, I don't think that prayer will have the same elements when the recession is clearly upon us.
All right, well, let's take that as a baseline and then move on a little bit here and talk about what people can do and what you're doing to stay somewhat safe or do your best in these coming kind of troubled waters.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Before I do that, I just want to make one comment. There's been tons of talk about NAFTA lately.
Okay.
And I just want to, and you notice that the administration said, well, they're going to drop out of NAFTA. Then the next day, the president says, well, I talked to the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of Mexico, and we're not going to drop out. We're going to renegotiate. I just want people to know that the chances of NAFTA ending are practically zero. So whenever you hear a NAFTA story like that, let it go. Don't even pay attention to it because it's not real. It's manufactured to keep people excited. It's a phony issue.
Yeah.
It's a talking point, phony issue to keep you distracted from what's really going on, which is that the economy is getting worse and unemployment's going up.
And why do you say that? Just to be clear.
Why is it a non-issue?
Yeah.
Oh, because the economies of Canada, U.S., and Mexico are so intertwined, it would cripple all three to end NAFTA. Not only that, but NAFTA is, what, 30 years, some years old at this point? I think Bill Clinton finally signed NAFTA, although it was negotiated by, I think it was negotiated by Reagan. No, it was negotiated by Bush, and Bush won, and it was actually executed by Clinton. So that's quite a while ago. So there were a lot of things in NAFTA that didn't get adequately addressed. For example, electronic commerce isn't even dealt with there, which obviously is a big issue. The worker protections are very weak in NAFTA. Environmental protections, very weak in NAFTA. So there's a lot of things in NAFTA that everybody, Democrats, Republicans, would say needs updating because, you got to revisit a treaty like that periodically. But it's not... It's fundamentally working for everybody. And if you look at, for example, NAFTA has been extraordinarily positive for the U.S. economy. It's been extremely positive for Mexico and extremely positive for Canada. So no one's losing. Everybody's winning, which typically happens when you open borders. So what you do is you go back and renegotiate the parts that you now know are weak. So we didn't know in the early 80s the full impact of electronic commerce. We do now. So you got to go deal with it. We didn't know about how badly out of whack worker protections would be if we didn't build them in. Instead, they put worker protections in side agreements. Well, you clearly have to put them in the main agreement. Same thing with environmental. It's carried in the side agreements. It's not in the actual agreement itself. So there's a lot of things you want to renegotiate that'd be smart for everybody. And I think Canada and Mexico wholeheartedly endorsed that and said so to Trump. But they're not going to get rid of it because it works too well for everybody. So it's a non-issue.
Very interesting. Thank you for extrapolating and explaining that. Let's go ahead and now talk a little bit, Ronaldo, about what people can do to prepare.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go there, and I want people to listen to this section. I think this is probably some of the most immediate advice people can take and actually add money to their pocketbook and protect themselves. Before we go there, though, Ronaldo, I want to just let our listeners know about the Optimist Daily. Optimist Daily, you know, we've been talking about some pretty dark stuff on this show, but if you want to hear good news and really substantial positive trends, I highly recommend logging on to optimistdaily.com and signing up for our daily weekday morning newsletter. It contains five very substantial and substantive, I mean, they really actually can affect your life, stories ranging from climate change mitigation to renewable energy to personal practices such as meditation, yoga, nutrition, wellness. It's all culled from around the world and is actually news you can use and will actually brighten your day instead of reading just the negative headlines.
Yeah, I think that I'm so glad you talked about it. You know, a statistic people should hear is that when we first tested that, and it was pretty primitive tested in a lot of ways, what, 8 months ago now, I didn't know how many people would quit after they got it, because a huge number of people took it as a percentage, just stunning numbers. And only 2% or less have dropped it in 8 months. That tells you how much people love it.
Yeah.
And they do. I get so many people complimenting me. Oh, thank you for doing that. Please send it to my friends, et cetera, et cetera. And we made it easier to share with a friend now. So share the fact that there's lots of solutions out there. We just have to keep pushing to get them to happen. You know, I was just we just sponsored James Fellows from The Atlantic here in Santa Barbara for a day and a half of conversation. And one of the things he was talking about is 54,000-mile trip around America in a one-engine plane, going to all the places that no one even visits, practically. I mean, yeah. He didn't come to Santa Barbara. He went to Fresno.
Right.
He didn't go to Philadelphia. He went to Erie, Pennsylvania. And what he was talking about was stuff is working at the local level. It's only at the federal level that everything is so broken. In other words, people, when they look at their neighbors one-on-one, are able to work together.
Right.
It's the divisiveness of national politics that causes these disruptions. And it's the fact that when you're in a community, a small town, it's one man, one vote, or one woman, one vote. At the national level, you don't have that. You have gerrymandered districts that elect congressmen, state governments, legislators, and ultimately Congress and the president.
Let me give a quick example of that just while we're talking about it here, Ronaldo. So yesterday I was at a meeting of the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors, and that's the county I live in up here in Northern California, outside of the city of Richmond. And the meeting was about joining what's called a community choice energy system, where essentially the counties get to take control over the power mix that they buy through the grid, instead of just taking whatever the big utilities say they can have. This actually manifests as counties hitting their climate change goals in terms of reduction of carbon dioxide much, much faster. I believe Marin County hit theirs 8 years ahead of schedule. This is an innovative policy that's pretty under the radar in some ways, but it's sweeping California. And what it means practically for me is that I'm going to be able to put I'm going to be able to cover my home, my roof, and solar panels, and the new community choice energy system actually is going to buy all the energy I can produce at retail rates, which is much better deal than I was getting would have gotten from the utility, who wouldn't even let me produce extra energy and share it with my neighbors. This is one example of many of the things that are actually working in our communities, and the way climate change is going to continue to get addressed for now is at the local and municipal level.
Matt, just to take that point just for 1 second, you were talking about Optimist Daily, and you just used the words carbon reduction, right?
Yeah.
The lead story in the Optimist Daily today was the first commercial plant to extract carbon dioxide from the air and inject it into greenhouses to grow vegetables faster is going online, fully operational, this month in Switzerland. People don't know that. Now, I've been talking on this show for a couple of years. I've said CO2, it's ambient. It flows around the world. We can scrub the air for CO2, and we should. Take a look at that article at the Optimist Daily, and you'll find out that we now can not only scrub the air for CO2, we can use it to grow vegetables. That's exciting. Yeah. That's what Optimist Daily tells you about. As to your comment about the community choice energy, which gives you the ability to put photovoltaic panels on your roof. Look, I got to tell you, if we had an even playing field, if we weren't subjected to the greed of basically two major monopolies in this state, PG&E and Southern California Edison, if we were not subjected to their greed, as you know, and it's the Moonshot Project that we talk about here at the Academy, we'd be 100% green energy in California in 10 years or less. That's a stunning statement. And by the way, the conversion cost would be zero, meaning it wouldn't cost the public more to make that conversion. And yet we continue, as recently as 2 weeks ago, to authorize through the Public Utilities Commission in California the purchase of new fossil fuel plants. It's crazy. It's just totally crazy. And now that you know from personal experience that you could economically create energy on your roof cheaper than anybody can sell it to you through a utility, you realize why they're so afraid. They're afraid that the monopoly they have is coming unwound. And you know what? They're right. It is. But I'm hoping that we will, as a citizenry, be astute enough to realize it's our pocketbooks that are being picked, and that we will force our elected leaders and their appointed officials to start representing our interests in San Francisco and Sacramento and beyond, so that we actually can convert this country to completely green energy. Because even as cheap as oil is right now, there's no reason to keep burning it.
So, Rinaldo, here's a segue question for you. Would you recommend people to prepare for this recession invest in solar panels?
Yeah, I would. I'll tell you why. And again, there's a wide spectrum of choices with solar. So on one end of the spectrum is, I just want to replace my electrical bill and get it down as low as I can. On the opposite end of the spectrum is, I don't want to be dependent on electricity from the grid at all. I want to be completely an island unto myself. Now, depending on which of those you choose, we would tell you where to go. But as a purely economic investment, purely meaning only about saving money, not about resilience or security, energy security. And there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about energy security, by the way, both from terrorism, from, you know, a chipmunk that brought down the Northeast one time not too long ago. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be, you know, want to deal with energy security. But if you're just saying, how can I save money? Probably the best investment you can make in any state would be to buy solar panels. Let me give you some actual numbers. Here in where I live, Santa Barbara, California, and a similar number is true where you live in Contra Costa, I pay 19 cents per kilowatt for every for the energy I use in my home, 19 cents per kilowatt. I put a photovoltaic system on my house, and amortizing it fully over 25 years, the cost of my energy has now dropped to 6 cents, actually about 5.5, 6 cents per kilowatt.
That's pretty good.
It's 13% improvement, 13 cent improvement. So I'm saving a ton of money. And that's totally apart from the federal tax credits I got. And it's totally apart from the state tax credits I got. I'm just talking about the raw cost of producing the energy. It's so much cheaper. When you think about it, of course it's cheaper. You're creating it on your roof and you're pumping it downstairs. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And they call that behind-the-meter reduction of energy, meaning behind the meter you have the connection to the grid. You're allowed to save as much energy as you want. Well, I would say bring that savings down to the point where you're paying 10 bucks a month for your real electrical bill, and everything above 10 bucks a month, you're being had because you can make it cheaper on your roof.
Yep. Okay.
And I don't know of a single state in America where that's not true.
Well, that's good advice. What else do you want to tell people about how they should be rebalancing or thinking about their savings in terms of this recession we're going into?
Okay. So as you know, from prior conversations, some of this is repetitive, some of this is new. I think it's time now to get out of the general stock market, meaning you don't want to be in funds. And I instructed my financial advisor literally yesterday to do what I'm about to tell you. So I said, you know what? I don't trust the S&P 500 anymore because I know it's coming down. Is it coming down in a month? Is it coming down in 6 months? I don't know. I'm not that smart, but I know it's coming down. So I don't want to be there when it comes down. So where do I want to invest my money so I can get a reasonable return? And remember, when it works well, the S&P reflects the growth in the overall economy because it's 500 stocks, not 30. And so if you got an economy that's growing at 0.7% and going into recession, What does that tell you the stock market's going to do? It can't grow much more than 0.7%, right? So that's a pretty low return. And that's if it was going to keep going up, which it's not. So since I've decided the market is, it's at about where it's going to go, it's not going to go much higher. There's very little upside potential left. Huge amount of downside potential, 20 to 30%. Time to leave the general stock market. So get out of those mutual funds that you own that have S&P stocks. Now, which is the general market. We've already told people put 15% in gold, which, as you know, I've done a couple months ago. I went from 10 to 15%. I think that's still a good number, 15% gold. I think you can get into a no-load mutual fund, which emphasizes dividend stocks. I've talked a lot about dividend stocks. I'll give you an example. You can get Ford Motor today, and they'll pay you 5% interest on your money as a dividend. And that dividend's not going to go away. In fact, Ford declared a special dividend of an extra nickel just in the first quarter because they have a lot of cash. General Motors is paying over 5% as a dividend. GE is paying over 4.5%. These are much more attractive numbers than 0.7% growth. These are much more attractive. And when the market drops, as it will, the stocks that are paying dividends will be protected against that drop because people will buy those stocks in order to get a yield, meaning to get cash back. So there's only two reasons to it. Well, one reason to invest in the stock market. You want to make money. So if you want to make money and you know the market's going to come down, you don't want to be betting on the market height. You want to be betting on those companies that can pay you cash in the form of dividends predictably for the next, you know, many, many, many years. And in this world, when you can get 5 or 4% with companies like Ford and GM and GE, I mean, you know, just buy the stock and sit on it. You don't care what the price is because your dividend doesn't go down. It stays the same. And in fact, in all those companies will tend to go up over time. Now, you do not want, however, what's called a mixed yield fund. A mixed yield fund means it has dividend stocks in it, and it also has bonds. So I instructed my financial advisor, do not invest in any mutual fund, no-load mutual fund, where there are bonds. I want dividend stocks only. Now, some of you do not have accounts big enough that you can buy individual stocks like Ford, GM, and GE. 3M is another one, by the way. But for those of you who do, you can buy some individual stocks. And if you can't, just tell me you want to get into a no-load mutual fund. I would recommend that you further hedge it, that it doesn't have any nuclear in it, because I think nuclear is in just a world of trouble. I mean, look, the entire company Toshiba is about to go bankrupt because of nuclear. So you don't want to have nuclear. I don't think military is a good idea because I don't think the budget for military is going to go that much higher. And as I said earlier, 12 to 15 billion more is not that much. It's a drop in the ocean. So I think that you want to get no bonds, get a dividend yield fund, mutual fund, so you can get in and out of it, no load. And if you buy individual stocks, look at the stocks that predictably have paid dividends for 10 years or more, have a history of raising the dividend over time, and that will give you downside protection when the market does drop and will give you current yields that are, I mean, think about it, Matt. Where can you get 5.5%, 5.4%? What kind of investment will give you that with security of knowing that Ford isn't going to go broke? And it's not.
Right.
That's it. I mean, that's what I would do.
And also, you're sticking with your 15% in gold, is that right?
Yep, I said, yeah, I put 15% in gold and I would stay there.
Yep, okay,
I don't think I'd raise it, I don't think I'd drop it. And the reason is, see, if you have, let's say, which is probably accurate, I'm probably getting about a 6-7% yield at least on my portfolio right now. And if you take 15% of that away and you park it in gold where you can't get any interest, it's purely an insurance policy, I don't want to spend more than 15% of my income on insurance.
Right.
That's a fairly high number, actually.
Okay, well, that's useful. And Ronaldo, you know, we have a couple of topics to cover here. I think they're connected, but let's start with climate change and then talk about oil prices.
Oh, sure. Well, climate change is, you know, you heard me started using this term several years ago, environmental refugees. And I was referring to the people in Africa 2 years ago who started flooding to Europe because their countries became so dry that famine and disruption of people there caused them to want to flee to Europe. And that really was a bigger number, actually, than the people who fled from Syria. Well, that term, environmental refugee, is increasingly going to become something people will talk about. Let me give you an example. The Midwest, and specifically Missouri and Arkansas, are getting drowned again with tornadoes slamming it. And that storm is now moving on to Texas. By the way, I think they're expecting 4 inches more in Missouri today on top of all the floods they've already had. And most of the homes, many of the homes affected in Missouri, I've heard just this afternoon, actually were also victimized in a similar flood just a year ago. So although localities are trying to get better at dealing with floods, the bottom line is when you have an increase in the moisture in the air because of global climate change. So as you heat the atmosphere, more water is absorbed from the oceans in the form of moisture. That moisture has to come down somewhere. And when two fronts collide, what would otherwise be a normal rainfall becomes a deluge. So you can have a drought for a couple of years and then a deluge afterwards. Now, the tragedy is those places which are the most resistant to understanding climate change issues, those are the ones that are getting hammered the worst. It's Missouri, it's Arkansas, it's Oklahoma, it's to a certain extent Texas, it's Mississippi, it's to a certain extent Alabama.
In Florida in other ways.
In Florida in other ways. So when you look at all those places, it's like, come on, folks, wake up and smell the coffee. And the bottom line is climate change is destroying where you live, and you are going to be left not being able to live there. Now, there is a temporary economic benefit to climate destruction, meaning when all those houses get wiped out by tornadoes and all those stores and when all those homes get flooded and new ones have to be built and contractors have to be brought in, there is a temporary one-time lift as it forces the government to spend money to help you repair in the form of government-guaranteed loans. But that only works for like a one-off. It doesn't work year after year after year because the government runs out of money. So what happens eventually is that people cannot rebuild. And the business they worked at might have gotten destroyed in a flood or a tornado anyway. So what happens is people go, wow, we can't live here anymore. Hot tip, you can't. And guess what? That's going to spread to larger and larger regions of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I read an article, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, about coastal Florida. It was in an insurance trade publication. And they were talking about essentially that people know that they're going to have to move out of these communities where there's like these floods in the middle of the day, just regular floods based on the tides. And the question is, how many times are they going to keep rebuilding until they realize that the property value there is actually zero?
And I can tell you the answer.
Yeah.
You know what the answer is?
What's
already happening? Insurance rates go up. As insurance rates go up, it becomes less economic. So what's happening is the snowbird, as it's called, migration of people living in the Northeast to Florida because it was a cheaper place to live in warm weather when you're older, so retirees, it doesn't work anymore. Because even if the properties are still reasonably priced, the insurance costs go up every year because, you know, Florida is tornado alley, it's hurricane alley, and it's rain alley. So Florida, and then now it's catching fire half the year. So Florida is, every year you're going to see inexorable increases in insurance, which means the cost to live there goes up every year. And as it goes up every year, of course, that means it's less desirable and people move out. So you're going to see net out migration. I predict Florida over the next 60 months, 5 years, will see significant net out migration, meaning more people will leave the state than come to the state.
So Ronaldo,
you can bank on that.
There was another big story that had to do with climate change that I actually missed and you brought to my attention on extreme air turbulence. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So one of the costs of climate change is you got to rebuild your house. You got to rebuild your business. The business community gets disrupted for 6 or 8 months. You get disrupted because all you can do is work on repairing your house and get the mud out of it and get the mold and all that other stuff dealt with. So there's a huge cost to climate change. It's in the tens of billions a year. But there's this other cost people have begun to realize, which is, and remember, the airlines are already starting to suffer from the Trump administration's adverse publicity. So you see airlines cutting back service. You see Delta, American, and United having reduced overseas revenues, which are their most lucrative markets, by the way, much more lucrative than domestic. So, you know, it's already costing us to be as crazy as we're being as a country. But there's this other thing that's happened that the CBS was basically really was the one reporting the story correctly yesterday. So we're now experiencing unbelievable clear air turbulence, which has now been traced clearly to climate change. And one of the places it's the most heavily predicted to affect us is on the transatlantic flight route between Maine and Europe, which is where all our all planes from America go over the over from Maine to northern Europe. That's how they get there, because it's shorter to go over the top of the globe. Well, that air turbulence, which now a 777 was involved in 2 days ago, a 777 aircraft is the largest aircraft Boeing makes. It's huge. So to move one of those things around in the air, you got to have a massive amount of air messed up. And clear air turbulence means you can't see it if you're a pilot because there's no clouds around. Then all of a sudden you lose air and the plane starts to drop out of the sky. Every single person who wasn't seat belted in as they're supposed to be, and please do that, folks. I've got over 2.5 million air miles on my body, and I never, ever leave my seatbelt unfastened if I'm sitting in my seat. Just leave it loose, doesn't have to be tight, but leave it there, because if you ever hit clear air turbulence, what happened to 64 people in that Boeing aircraft is they smashed up against the ceiling of the aircraft, and almost immediately they were smashed to the floor of the aircraft. Literally 64 of them broke bones and were injured. And I don't know how many people were just shaken up. But though every one of those 64 wasn't wearing their seatbelt. So please, if you're going to fly, absolutely wear a seatbelt. Now, here's an interesting thing. CBS correctly identified that it was a direct result of climate change, and they directly connected that it was going to dramatically increase every year from here on out, meaning more clear air turbulence, more of these incidents going forward. They incorrectly assumed that by the year 2200, air travel over the Atlantic might not be possible as we know it today. That's wrong. It's actually going to happen much sooner than that. But at least they get where it's headed. Now, as they were reporting this story, mild-mannered Nora O'Donnell, who is certainly about as mild-mannered a commentator as I know on the news, said, well, you know, Charlie, I've been flying a lot across America, and I've been hitting more and more clear air turbulence all the time, and it's getting worse. So this is really happening. Climate change is really affecting clear air turbulence everywhere. It's just worse over the Atlantic. Is that what the story means? And Charlie said, yeah, that's what the story means. Of course it does. So I want people to be aware that's a huge cost to us. Can you imagine what it cost? By the way, the plane itself got badly beat up. It'll be back in service, I'm sure, after they x-ray it to make sure there aren't any serious cracks. It'll also be financially very unpopular to the airlines because it means the stress on an aircraft will increase, so they won't have as long a useful life, more expense. I mean, climate change is full of ways to lose money, and it's the only way to stop it is to reverse climate change. So, and I don't see that happening because today, even though that Swiss plant's going to open in a year or less in a month, it's going to be purging CO2, we're at 415 parts per million. 350 is what's safe. And that was measured at the top of a mountain in Hawaii, Mauna Loa. So if you got 450 parts per million, 415 parts per million there in Hawaii, that means it's 415 parts per million everywhere in the world. It's going up, folks. Every day it goes up. And we keep putting more and more CO2 in the air. So we are addicted. We're petroleum addicts, and it's literally killing us the way heroin does. We've got to pull the needle out of our arms. We've got to stop using this petroleum-based fuels, well, and that includes natural gas.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about petroleum-based fuels, specifically on something we like to monitor on this show, which is the price of oil. A lot of people back, 10, 15 years ago, were talking about the spike in oil prices and a tightening of oil supplies to the point where our economy would shut down as a result of lack of oil. Obviously, that hasn't come to pass in the same way because of new techniques and new finds. And actually, there's a massive oversupply in oil. And I'd like just to hear the latest on what you're seeing there.
Well, I mean, first of all, and I think I said this last month, I find it fascinating that the news about oil prices is so manipulated. So I reported to you that the good news out of the oil patch today was they reported that oil prices settled slightly higher. They're recovering from their current lows. And the total amount of the recovery was 16 cents. Now, that's not a recovery, folks. That's just plain silly. You know, to say that the price of oil went up by 16% and to call that the recovery, that's crazy. What's really going on? And we've covered it in the show. You know, this show has been consistently accurate in predicting the price of oil for years now. How do we do that? As I've said many times before, if you want to know what the price of oil is going to be, you got to know what the price per barrel is, the cost to frack. Right now, fracking can be done and make a profit at $45 a barrel. So where's the price of oil? Around $48 a barrel. Why? Because you'll pay a few bucks extra for the stuff you can drill out of the ground. But at the end of the day, if you need more oil, you'll just frack more. I am against fracking. I think it's a terrible technology. I don't think it should even be legal. But since it is, what's the positive is fact is it's keeping the price of oil low no matter what OPEC does. So OPEC announced a couple months ago that they were going to continue to keep their 1.4 million barrel a day reduction in place of pumping, which, by the way, they've done. Now it's in their ninth month, and it didn't raise the price of oil above 50 bucks before, and it won't raise it above now. Because anytime the price of oil starts to go up, more people will frack. For example, in April, as of the April 28th, the estimate by the oil patch companies was that the 2.9 million barrels would be consumed and not replaced with the volume of production globally today. Turns out, in U.S. crude stockpiles, well, 2.9 million is the U.S., of course. Not only 930,000 barrels went down, and that's just a temporary blip because 930,000 barrels is actually nothing. So it went down less than half, about a third of what was predicted. Why is this happening? Why are we using less oil in America? Simple reason. We now have electric cars. We have plug-in hybrids. We have fuel economy standards, and even though the current administration, the Trump administration, is eliminating those, it's too late because California's not eliminating. They already announced 2 weeks ago they wouldn't. And by the way, all this stuff I'm telling you, folks, this is what I tweet about. So if you want to know what's going to happen during the month that we're not on the air, in between these shows, go to my tweets, and I cover this stuff so you can know what's really going on out there. California basically said 2 weeks ago it was not going to reduce or change the mileage standards in California. Now, the reason that's important is we are part of a compact, interstate compact, and I believe there's like 13 or 15 states now that are part of it. I'm not sure, Matt, the exact number. And what they all agree to do is to have the same fuel mileage standards as California. And with California keeping those standards at that level, that means the automobile industry will produce cars to that level. So even if Donald Trump said, you know what, I don't care if cars get 5 miles to the gallon, it won't matter because General Motors is going to build cars that can be sold in California. And in California, the mileage standards are going up. They're not going down. So you're going to see increasingly fuel-efficient cars. What else is happening? Well, a huge part of our energy system is fueled by natural gas. When you use natural gas to fuel your electrical grid, and your electrical grid uses less electricity because people are now conscious about home energy consumption of energy in their office buildings, you get more energy efficient, it reduces the demand. So even though we are virtually eliminating coal, and I'm happy to report as of yesterday, it looks like it's got to be the biggest coal plant in America, is the Four Corners plant in the Navajo Reservation, is going to close. Yeah. And it's due to close in a few months. So coal's being eliminated, which would tend to say, gee, well, then there'll be more demand for natural gas and oil. But the increase in demand from the closure of coal plants is not enough to compensate for the reduction in demand because we're driving smarter and we're insulating our homes and offices smarter. What a concept.
Well, I like that optimistic note, Ronaldo. Thank you for ending on that. Is there anything else you want to add here before we sign off?
Now, just one last thing. I got to tell you, if you folks heard Andy Putzner talk the other day about how jobs will be caught lost if we raise the minimum wage to $15, which this show strongly supports as being extremely stimulative and good for the economy. A $15 minimum wage is not only good for the people who get it, it's great for the economies in the cities where it's paid. And the best example is Seattle, Washington. They've had it now. It went in early 16. The economy's been growing. They've been adding more jobs than the national average. No fast food chains have closed, as Andy Pudzner said they would, who he runs Carl's Jr. Not, they haven't been closing Carl's Jr.'s. They haven't been closing McDonald's. They haven't been closing Burger King. Because it turns out when you put $15 in the pocket of the average worker as a minimum wage, he goes to McDonald's and Carl's Jr. and Burger King more often. So it's a great, it's not an experiment anymore. It's a great fact. Raising the minimum wage raises the economy and everybody wins, particularly the local butcher, baker, and candlestick maker. On that happy note, I think we can close.
All right, Ronaldo, thanks for listening, everybody. And you can find Ronaldo on Twitter at Ronaldo Brutico is the Twitter handle. If you search for Ronaldo Brutico, you'll find him that way. Until next time, keep watching the news and keep tuning in to The Optimist Daily, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, everyone.